Well, hello everyone, and today I'm going to be reviewing a stream that David Starkey did recently, an interview that he did with the former Chancellor of the Exchequer and general Tory scumbag Jeremy Hunt. This was actually sent to me by Connor Tomlinson, who said, I'd be interested to see you review this. I haven't watched it, but it is of interest because it's a rare opportunity to see Hunt confronted on the fact that the Tories made peace with the Blairite state and what Peter Hitchens, you know, he has a whole book on it, The Cameron Delusion. So this is of interest to me. I don't know. I mean, it's quite a long thing. I don't know how much of it we're going to get through, but I'm going to try to do as much as I can, as long as this Ramona Lones specially select lasts. I've got my Coke Zero here. So let's give it a watch. Before we get going, pick up courses at the Academic Agency. Mega Bundle is selling. For some reason, there's been a lot of Mega Bundle sales recently. So that's what people are choosing to buy over Easter. But you can pick up all sorts of different courses. Buy it now, buy it now. But let us get going with Starkey.
Hello and, gosh, that's a bit loud. Hello and welcome to David Starkey Talks. I'm not quite sure I'm actually believing this, but we're talking in the Sheldonian, the grandest possible building in Oxford, constructed in the immediate aftermath of that first great restoration in 1660 to represent the new power of the monarchy, and an Oxford flourishing in having been cavalier, as opposed to my own deplorable university on the other side. To add to the sense of ultra-establishment, this is the Oxford Literary Festival.
It's a little bit quiet, but unfortunately it's as loud as it will possibly go. So maybe I'll try to fiddle with this in post-production or something, but it's a bit quiet for me. I don't know if it is for you.
Festival, and to cap, I think, one's feeling of being welcomed by establishment, I'm delighted to be talking to Jeremy Hunt. And we were trying to work out whether he was the longest serving cabinet minister in the government of 2010 to 2014. And we came to the conclusion the only possible rival was actually Michael Gove. So I think we will leave that hanging in the air. And Jeremy, like everybody else at a literary festival, has written a book last year called Can We, That's Britain, Be Great Again? A sort of deliberate echo of MAGA, but with a profoundly different message. When I read the book, which I did a little while ago and then reread it this morning, the first word that came to me, and I'm hoping this gets Jeremy very cross, was Panglossian. Do you remember the Dr. Pangloss in Voltaire's novel Candide, who believed that we were in the best of all possible worlds? How would you respond to that charge? Because it is, isn't it? You tell me in this book, let's just look at today's news. You tell me in this book that we remain the Europe's greatest military power, citing statistics of 2019. Today, I read that one of the leading generals in the Defence Review says, on a good day, we might be able to take a small town. So, you see why I say Panglossian.
I think we're going to really enjoy this afternoon, I'm absolutely delighted to say not guilty. If Panglossian means unrealistic to the point of ridicule, then absolutely not.
No, it wasn't ridiculing.
No,
it was presenting evidence.
Yes, I know, and I'm about to present the evidence as to why it's not Panglossian. Because the truth is that all Europe's defences are in a shockingly bad state, not just the UK's,
France did rather better.
Well, hang on. You've got to let me answer the question, haven't you, David? And no, I think actually the UK's defence forces are about the same as France's. But what I would say is that we all need to do a lot better on defence. And if we are going to stand on our own two feet and not be pushed around by America or Russia or the other great powers, then we need to be able to defend ourselves. And Britain is one of only a tiny handful of countries that is willing to project power outside its own region. We have incredible traditions in our armed forces, and we need to do something about that. We need to make the most of those tremendous traditions. So my argument in this book is not that everything is hunky-dory. It's actually quite the opposite. I think the world is more dangerous than at any time since the Cold War, when we worried about nuclear conflagration. But in that situation, the most dangerous thing of all is to underestimate your own abilities, your own capabilities. And we have always been one of Europe's leading defence powers, if not the leading defence power. And this is a time when countries need to roll up their sleeves and play their part in making the world safer. And actually, if you said to me...
I should say that there's a very strong Tory establishment, I would just say regime push at the moment to get defence spending. I know they're talking about 3%, but I think ultimately they're trying to push for 10% defence spending. With a reduction of welfare to compensate for this. I've heard this on a lot. This is an ongoing talking point on the LBC. And I would say this is very much the context in which Hunt is talking here.
Me, and this was something when I was Foreign Secretary, I used to give all these speeches about how brilliant Britain was at this and that. And, you know, that's part of your job as Foreign Secretary. You're sort of salesman in chief for the country. And I thought, what is it that people really want from Britain? What's the single thing we could do that could most add value in the world? And I thought, actually, it is to keep the world safe, because most people recognize...
Oh, come on. Britain's going to be the global policeman. Come off it, mate. Can barely get one ship into the Med. Global policeman. Delusional.
That we have historically had very good armed forces. And we don't want to go back to a world of might is right. I don't agree with Donald Trump on that. And I don't want to see the world carved up between America, China and Russia. And I think that's a profoundly dangerous vision of the world. Well, those of us with a different view, if we want to have the...
Yeah, I mean, whether you like it or not, it is what is happening, isn't it? Realism, Jeremy. That is literally what is happening as we speak. And in that context, where you've got great powers and a multipolar world opening up, you want Britain to act as a global policeman? This is not serious thinking. This is not the work of a serious mind.
The influence to exercise it, then we need things like...
Sorry, this is infinitely unrealistic, isn't it? I mean, let's again look frankly.
Thank you, David. Thank you for saying what we were all thinking. Infinitely unrealistic. I absolutely agree.
At the last few weeks. The last few weeks brought about by Trump's intervention in Iran. There is that wonderful remark about Warren Buffett that you only see who is wearing a swimming costume when the tide goes out. The revelation of Britain's absolute nakedness in defence. It has been genuine national humiliation. The ambiguity of our conduct, the inability of us to put a ship in the right place, the fundamental questions over the serviceability, the fact that so much of it is out of operation, the immediate revelations about the catastrophe of the Ajax program. I mean, sorry, you're talking a good talk, but there is absolutely no connection with reality. We've just heard repeatedly from our leading generals, leading defense experts, that we are effectively naked. We spend more on defense than Israel, with infinitely less effect. But let's just pick another idea, that we have a generalized duty to world peace. This seems to me to be a very, very odd notion.
Thank you, David. Starkey is redeeming himself after his unfair treatment of Rupert Lowe the other week. He is redeeming himself here by correctly grilling Jeremy Hunt, or as I like to call him, Swindon Branch.
Only the kind of power that we were in the 19th century can possibly do that. You are talking, the guardian of world peace has got to be a hegemon. The last time we had remotely the powers of a hegemon is about 1918.
Well, okay, let me deal with some of the nonsense in what you've just said. First of all, the book actually...
Ooh, he's come out swinging! Let me deal with some of the nonsense you just said. Ooh! He's come firing back. Okay, let's see what he says.
Actually, chapter one of the book is all about defence. And there's probably about 10 pages that go into enormous detail about the terrible shortcomings in our defence offer. I don't pull my punches on that. It's one of the reasons why, incidentally, I increased defence spending to 2.5% when I was Chancellor, because it's something I felt very strongly about. But, you know, I went to a conference last year in which I heard one of the most senior American admirals in the US Navy, who's responsible for the Indo-Pacific fleet. So if the balloon goes up in Taiwan, he'll be the man responsible. And he said a really interesting phrase. He said, "Hope is the first duty of command." And I have to say, the kind of negativity that I heard from you just then, David, reminded me of the 365 economists who wrote into the Times saying that Margaret Thatcher's economic policies were wholly wrong. And I have to say that I accept 100% your charge that our armed forces are not able to do what we need them to do, and we need to do a lot more, and we need to do it fast. But I don't accept that we can't get them to the place they need to be. And I would say that if there is a country that has the...
Okay, what the fuck is he talking about? Oh, hope is the first duty of command. Hope? What are you talking about? We're talking about raw Machtpolitik here, Jeremy. You're talking about... You started this saying we need to be the global, one of the global policemen, and now you're talking about hope? What's hope? What's hope to Vladimir Putin? Or Chairman Xi, or the Ayatollah. I mean, this is nonsense, absolute nonsense.
Potential outside the United States, if there's a democracy that has the potential to build up its armed forces so that they can be a force for good in the world, then it's probably the US, Britain, France, perhaps Australia and Canada. But it's a very small list. And the question is whether we actually are prepared to roll up our sleeves and do that. And am I saying that we're going to be the world's policemen on our own? Of course not. Completely unrealistic. But should we work together with other countries who say that we don't want to go back to a world in which might is right, in which countries are able to just invade their neighbours? Well, it just so happens there are lots of other countries that agree with that. Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Australia, New Zealand, Canada. And I think one day America as well, because I don't think that Trump is America, and I think that we should always hold the door open to the world's most powerful democracy, however much we worry about the direction it's gone so late.
I think we do actually agree on the fundamentals. What I'm trying to say is, in the world as it is now, with Keir Starmer as Prime Minister, the chances of any of this happening are infinitely remote. I mean, he has promised to increase defence expenditure, but not yet. You quote St. Augustine in the book. He is constantly St. Augustine. Give me defence, but not yet. And you know perfectly, you of all people, with your experience as Chancellor, how absolutely unrealistic it is at the moment to think any extra money can be found for anything, it seems to me. That we are looking at, look, for example, you succeeded as Chancellor in the immediate wake.
I mean, the whole thing is wrong-headed. I don't understand why Starkey has conceded this idea of wanting to be global policeman with bloody Canada and Australia and New Zealand and France. How about just concentrate on fundamental defence of this island, first and foremost? You know, we don't have the empire anymore. So what's all this policing business going on? What's he on about?
Of Liz Truss. In the last few days, there were moments when gilts actually went higher than in that crisis. We are at the absolute financial margins. People are talking openly. Today in the Times, Paul Ovenden, who, believe it or not, I find it difficult to believe, but Keir Starmer apparently had a director of strategy. Can you believe? I mean, you know, seeing absolutely no evidence of any strategy on anything. He says we are at a moment of 1976, or we're at a moment of Suez, that we are on a knife edge. And we're on a knife edge, of course, without leadership. Can we just, again, you said that your book offered a message of hope. I think it does. But haven't we to be more realistic? I mean, let's shift slightly now to the consequences of that 14 years and the 11 of those that you served as a cabinet minister.
The 14 years of hurt over which you, traitor to this nation, Jeremy Hunt, presided. How are you going to account for yourself?
The Conservative Party experienced its worst ever defeat, and you barely hung on to a seat in leafy Surrey. Now,
he's the politician here, by the way. Where I'm sitting right now, the local MP is Jeremy Hunt. And that yummy mummy cafe I go to, he went down there during the election, I remember. And he was, the local staff were on his website and so on. It's quite funny. And then I asked them, I went down there and I said, you guys like Jeremy Hunt? He was like, no, they came in and they took a picture. I'm not going to vote Tory. That's what the woman said to me. So anyway.
Doesn't that suggest perhaps that something rather structural went wrong? And I can't see any trace in what you write that there's an awareness of that.
Okay, let's unpick. You've jumped around there a bit, David. Don't we just say that?
It's called moving the discussion on.
Moving the goalposts. So let me just be clear. This book is about Britain's role in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's called Can We Be Great Again? And my definition of great is not Donald Trump's definition of great. My definition is a very straightforward one. I say a great country is one that can shape the world as well as be shaped by it. And I still believe, despite the...
So your definition of great is meaningless, is it? That can shape the world as well as be shaped by it. That's not much of a definition of great, is it? I mean, it's just flimsy. Oh, I hate people like this.
Incredibly disappointing, depressing failures of modern Britain today, that we are a country that can continue to shape the world. And this is what I make the argument for in this book. But I don't, and I think it's very important to say, I don't gloss over in any way at all the problems that we face as a country. But it's about what we can do in the world. Now, you talked about Keir Starmer. I don't think it's going to surprise people in here if I reveal, shock, horror, probe, scandal, that I am not a supporter of Keir Starmer's government.
I mean, but how about just leave the world alone for a bit? You know, Arnold Toynbee talks about taking a time out, a bit of a time out, right? Britain has had 350 years of worrying about the world. How about just chilling out for a bit and, you know, sorting out your backyard for a moment before you worry about what the rest of the world is doing? Okay, and if you want to increase defence expenditure, you know, just set it up in a defensive capacity for the time being. Okay, turtle for a bit. Look, I mean, you're looking at Iran. Iran is showing what it can do at the moment, but it has spent the best part of 30 years turtling in order to be able to do this, okay, with heavy sanctions placed upon it, but yet it has been able to surprise people by having capabilities beyond what anybody imagined. Maybe Britain should have a time out for a little bit, get its industry back up and running, sort things out, get some of the demographic issues under control, and so on and so forth, before you start worrying about what we can quote-unquote do in the world. If anybody's earned to time out, it's this country.
So I very much hope it is like 1976, and that we are 3 years away from a determined new Conservative government that will start another process of national renewal. And that's why I stood as a Conservative MP, and that's what I believe in. So I'm not going to waste any...
I think it's worth putting a bit of context into this reference to 1976, though. What happened in 1976? That was when Harold Wilson, off the top of my head, this is, that was when Harold Wilson abruptly resigned for reasons, and James Callaghan took over as the Labour leader. And then you had strikes, and you had the winter of discontent, and then you had the Thatcher Revolution in 79. Okay. But what led up to that? What did Labour inherit in 1974 when Harold Wilson was voted back in? Well, they inherited the three-day week from the Tories. Ted Heath in 1974 was facing massive union strikes from the coal industry, from the miners, which led to an energy crisis because there was a coal shortage at the same time as there was an oil shock in 1973-74 owing to the Arab war with Israel and the price shock that happened in 73-74. Okay, I mean, I'm just very quickly giving you a York Notes version of history here. So that Labour government inherited a bit of a shit show from Ted Heath. They took us into Europe in 1975. The IMF stepped in 1976. Okay, but that wasn't just kind of Labour mismanagement. That was a situation where they inherited an absolute mess from the Tory party. And then if you look at it instrumentally, what Margaret Thatcher did, okay, to deal with the political problem of the miners and the coal industry holding the country over a barrel that led to the three-day week, and to deal with the winter of discontent and so on, she came in and she smashed the unions, centralized power, and shut down the coal industry. So basically to take away the power from the workers, okay, versus the government. That led to a process of deindustrialization and financialization of the country, which has led us to a point where now in 2026, we barely have any industry anymore. And we don't have a coal industry anymore. And that means that we're reliant on a certain amount of energy imports, despite North Sea oil and North Sea gas being there. Okay, and despite the quote-unquote diversification of the energy industry and the building of millions of wind farms all across Wales and England and so on and so forth, despite all of that, we still don't have the energy security we might have had because Thatcher literally shut down our industry, or a huge swathe of our industry, not all of it, of course, and took us down this road of being a quote-unquote service-based economy. That's basically what happened here. So let's just put into context what they're talking about. Now, you can have a look at productivity and growth and GDP per capita growth. I recently trended on Twitter because I normalized, okay, that is adjusted for inflation, GDP per capita growth, and expressed it in constant 1980 gold, pound sterling, right? Great British pounds. That trended. I even had a retweet from Edwina Curry because it showed that since it actually showed that under Wilson even under Heath and under Harold Macmillan and during the post-war consensus, there was significant GDP per capita growth, okay, in 1980 pounds. And Thatcher had very low growth when you take inflation into account, okay? And once you hit the 2010 David Cameron government, it's all downhill. We're talking massive downhill. Now, there's a peak under Blair, okay? It goes down under Brown, and then it goes down and down and down again, okay? That is actually what we're talking about here. So I don't think speaking about the Thatcher Revolution in these sorts of rosy terms, as Jeremy Hunt and David Starkey is, they've got the rose tinted specs on. Okay, let's actually think. I mean, you can measure it in such a way that shows a rosy picture, but let's not forget they inflated the hell. They printed a lot. This was monetarism. This was Milton Friedman. You can print your way out of, you know, supply side economics and all of this. But if you actually look at the underlying productivity and the underlying growth and things like median wages versus spot prices or house prices in the real economy, actually there's been a lot of flatlining, and under the 14 years of her, it actively goes downhill, and the wages are almost completely stagnant since the peak of the Blair era. That is actually what we're talking about here. Sorry to go off on my soapbox, ladies and gentlemen, but these sorts of things irritate me.
Time criticizing the Conservative government. If you're saying, you know, what happened in 2024 and was there something structural? And I'm going to try and be as non-partisan as I can, although it's obviously difficult to be completely objective, having been in the cabinet for 11 of those 14 years. We didn't get everything right, for sure. We made big mistakes. I can think of a number of big ones, but I think migration is probably the one that stands out the most. But the truth is that after 14 years, people were very, very tired.
You can't just say, oh, migration was the big one. Why did you do it? Explain why you did it. Why did you take those actions? He's just admitted that it was a deliberate decision. So why did you do it? You were the Chancellor.
Tired, and they wanted a change. And it was a very difficult 14 years because something happened in that 14 years that has never happened in our lifetimes before. Normally what happened is that you have an economic crisis once in a generation, and then a government picks up the pieces, brings down the national debt, and then a decade or so later, maybe the same thing happens again. But in that period of 14 years, we had to cope with three crises in quick succession, global crises, the global financial crisis or the aftermath of it, COVID, and the Ukraine energy shock. And they were body blows to the economy, which meant...
You made choices in each of those cases, though, didn't you? Didn't have to do the lockdowns, for example. Didn't have to join the Ukraine war enthusiastically, did you? Didn't have to do any of those things. Didn't have to put sanctions on Russia, did you, Jeremy? You could have chosen otherwise, couldn't you? Think about it. So two of those three crises were self-inflicted in the cold light of day.
That our growth rate never really recovered. We were never able to bring down our debt in between crises, which meant that our debt as a share of GDP went up. And that's why it was, after that period, it was a pretty difficult sell to say to people, things have got better, because actually people felt pretty browned off because so many things had gone wrong. Now, we we didn't do, as I say, some things right. But I think the most important thing that people want from a Conservative government is to take the tough and difficult decisions to put.
Why was there such negative real terms growth under Cameron? Okay, that accounts for 2020, 2021, 2022, and since then. What about the previous decade? Because the growth was sluggish under Cameron and so-called austerity and hug a hoodie and, you know, gay marriage, David Cameron. What the hell was all that about? Where you significantly liberalize large parts of the economy, including immigration, where you brought in the gig economy and championed it, right? There's your Deliveroo drivers and your 0 hours contracts and all of these things that have noticeably made the country shitter, should I say. And the rise of the vape shops and the rise of the barber shops and the death of the high street. All of these things happened under David Cameron.
The economy back on its feet. And without talking about my own record, if I look at George Osborne when he became Chancellor, £1 in every four that the government was spending in 2010 was being borrowed. So an NHS that cost £100 billion a year, we were borrowing £25 billion. That's how shot to pieces our national finances were. He cut spending far more savagely than Margaret Thatcher ever did. She cut it by, I think, 2%. In the biggest year that she ever cut it, it was by 3%. He cut it over 4 years by 19%. And we're still unpopular today for the austerity period, and not all of the decisions that we took were right. But the principle...
But it didn't lead to an economic... You see, the thing is, you can do all this stuff, right? But did it result in the gains promised by the Laffer curve? Did it result in a blossoming of entrepreneurship? Did it lead to a revival of, you know, people doing it for themselves in the big society? These are all the things promised. Didn't materialize. Didn't happen under Cameron. Didn't happen under May. Didn't happen under Johnson.
Which was that we need to get the deficit down and get the economy back growing again. That was something that he took those difficult decisions. So are there structural things wrong with our democracy? As it happens, I think there are.
Would you like to list them?
Yes. I think that I think when I look at the challenge of, for example, trying to get the economy growing, which was something that I was very intricately involved with as Chancellor, I think we have passed laws that just make it too long and too difficult to get things done. So if Parliament decides that we want to build a nuclear power station and votes for it, and the Treasury agrees to provide the money, it takes 15 years before, as a minimum, before the nuclear power station opens. That is far too long. If we want to build a high-speed rail line between London and...
I would just like to reiterate that the Tories had a supermajority under Johnson and that they could have just repealed all those laws. They had a majority under Theresa May. They had a majority with the Lib Dems and under Cameron. I'm sure that the Lib Dems would have been on board with cutting some of that red tape. There's nothing in the Lib Dem kind of mindset that is against, that is for bureaucracy for its own sake. So moaning about this stuff after 14 years of government, it doesn't, or 11, you know, you were in for 11 years, doesn't quite cut the mustard, does it? Because it was just like, why didn't you sort it out? This is the whole problem with this Tory government. Constantly blaming, oh, the system, the rules. You're the fucking government. You can change them at any time with the majority. Oh, we didn't have the votes. You had the votes. You just got to, I mean, I just don't understand how they were not able to sort out some of these things in the time.
Birmingham, we end up having to build a tunnel to protect bats that costs £100 million, a total of something like £300,000 per bat saved. If we want to get houses built, it takes an infinitely long process, with the result that young people find it hard to get on the housing ladder. And there are various reasons why this has happened, but a lot of it is laws that we have passed, laws that, incidentally, outside the European Union, we have a lot more freedom to remove than we did before, but we haven't. And I do think that that has reduced people's confidence. I think people have a nagging worry that the politicians they send to Westminster just aren't able to solve the big problems.
But you were in power, or rather the Conservatives were in power, from 2010 to 2014.
Thank you, David.
The structure of law.
Thank you. The obvious question. Come on.
Or that you talk about was a deliberate creation of the Blair government. There was a deliberate intention to override anybody that had democratic accountability with the creation of a legal and expert structure. I've written about this at length, the shift of power to the 440-odd quangos, the quasi-autonomous non-governmental organisations, which certainly before the attempted demolition of the NHS quango, which was set up under the Conservative government, controlled roughly a third of state expenditure, with the deliberate view that the public could not actually have any, or indeed any politician, have any direct say, hence English Nature, hence the Buck Tunnel, hence the even larger fish disco for the, you know, the nuclear power station, the Buck Tunnel of 100 million, and the fish disco, 600 million. Again, the judicial power you refer to, deliberately the creation of the Supreme Court, of the exaggerated rights of judicial review, of the Equality Act, of the ECHR, you did nothing. You also entrenched...
You did nothing. Nothing. How is he going to respond to this? What's his excuse?
All of these things. The thing that is ultimately disastrous, which is, you know, facing us now with an immediate cost of living crisis, is the decision in 2015, which wasn't even subject to a formal, I think, an act of Parliament. It was simply a statutory instrument to bring forward net zero to 2050, which effectively gives judges control over extractive policy. These weren't simply that you didn't reverse what Labour had done. You actually intensified it, didn't you? I mean, again, your book has got... I mean, one of the things that I found striking about your book, it could have been written...
Go on, go for the kill, Starkey. Go on, you've got him on the ropes. Absolute facts spat by Dr. Starkey here.
By any centrist Labour politician. Exactly the same sort of things that you feature: climate change, human rights, soft power, creative industries. I mean, they're just absolute common ground. This is the stuff of the Uniparty, isn't it?
Well, no, for one very simple reason, which is exactly how you started this interview. You know, this book says one of the most important things we need to do is to increase defence spending, and Keir Starmer's not doing that. And you and I both know that a Conservative government would do.
Cop-out answer. Get back to why you didn't repeal the Blair shit. Get back to why you didn't get rid of this stuff when you were in power. Dodge. Come on. Come on, Starkey. Get him back on course.
Do that. So it's about...
You didn't.
Well, actually, I did. I increased defence spending to 2.5%.
Bye.
It's very easy to say that, David.
No, but
no,
true.
Hang on. It's very easy to say that out of context. Remember, when I became Chancellor, markets were in free fall, inflation was 11%, the economy was predicted to be facing the longest recession in 100 years, and defence spending, which for more than a decade had been at 2% of GDP, to find the resources to increase it to 2.5%, by the way, I think it needs to be even higher, was a big deal. And I don't apologise for that at all. I did the work to make sure we could do it, and now I want us to go further. I totally reject your suggestion that the Conservatives... It's a very easy Nigel Farage line to talk about the Uniparty. It's bollocks. Let's be clear. Yes, it is. And let me give you the...
Okay, I can't wait to hear this. Come on, then.
Evidence. When David Cameron came to office, we abolished nearly 150 of those quangos. Another 150 were merged into other quangos. I know, because I was responsible for 53 of them at the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, and I had to find about a dozen to get rid of. Francis Maude's civil service reform program cut the size of the civil service by 20%, a huge reduction in the number of civil servants. But I won't pretend that at that time, the biggest challenge we faced as a country was financial. We were about to go bankrupt, and the biggest focus of David Cameron and George Osborne was how to reduce the deficit. So I'm sure there were woke laws from the Blair era that we left in place.
You added to them.
Well, okay, I think the one...
Thank you, Dr. Starkey. Gay marriage, right? What else did he add to? They strengthened and empowered Ofcom. They gave new powers to Ofcom. Come on.
One that you think we added to is one where we will probably have a disagreement, because I do believe that we should live up to our responsibilities on climate change. I think that we have made a big mistake in our climate change policy, which is that we've adopted policies that have given us the most expensive energy prices in the developed world, and that is holding back the economy. So I think that was a mistake in our approach. But do I broadly think that we should be responsible when it comes to protecting the planet and setting an example when it comes to CO2 emissions? I do. I think that's a good thing. So on that one, I think we will probably have a disagreement.
But equally, the way, and again, one may dispute the, I mean, it seems to me that anything that one can do to alleviate the hideousness of smogs and the kind of things that we see in China and whatever that we used to have here is wholly welcome.
Climate change is not just about pollution. It's about much bigger risk to the planet. I'm aware,
but it has surely become a religion. And the notion that we've got a duty to set an example, this is an arrogance. This is a vanity to think that anybody is going to change their behavior, looking at Britain and saying, gosh, they're such an admirable country. I mean, have you seen the Chinese smitten with the notion that they really ought to follow our example? India? This seems to me to touch something absolutely fundamental. That one of the central things in your book, I think, forgive me, is a vanity. The notion of soft power is pure vanity. Power is real. Power depends on the ability to muster force. The shame of Britain over the last few weeks demonstrates when you try to strut above your strength. Soft power is an illusion. It's a myth. It's a comforting myth that we've sold ourselves. It was part of the late imperial notion of liberal empire that we were there for the benefit of the natives.
Starkey spitting facts here. Absolute fire from Starkey, and he's correct. This is a delusion. Got a good book here called Somebody Else's Empire goes into this. Got a very good book, actually, on the British Empire. This one here by James Hartfield, the Marxist historian. Here's my Zoltar card. And Hartfield has a whole, about a third of this book is about the attempt to transition the British Empire into a kind of soft power projection towards the end of the, starting in the end of the 19th century, where it was still the empire, but then going into the Commonwealth era and how it kind of, metastasizes into this human rights kind of order that they've tried to, it's a cope. Starkey's right. Let's see what Hunt says.
And it is simply that vanity projected into a post-imperial world. But can I just, again...
No, I think you've got to let me respond.
Okay,
because
fine.
If you're going to talk nonsense, then you have to let someone respond to
you
it.
You use and the I word... I never accuse you of talking nonsense.
But you've made very direct comments about the arguments in my book, so I'm going to make very direct comments about the nonsense you're talking. And I'm because
look, he comes out swinging again. Swindon branch, full of fire. For all the wrong things. Typical Tory.
The example I want to give is from this very university. So when I was a student at Magdalen College in 1985, I came up. I was perhaps the only Tory in my college. There weren't very many of us, but I was a proud supporter of Margaret Thatcher. And we had...
I hope little Tory boy Jeremy Hunt had his head flushed down the toilet on the regular in Magdalen College in the 80s. He would have absolutely deserved it as well.
And I had a Chinese friend who was a postgraduate student who came over to study with her husband. And I bumped into her one day in the quadrangle. And she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm going to a JCR debate where I have to speak in defense of the poll tax." It wasn't my most popular wicket at the time. And so I said, "Do you want to come along?" And she came along. And then we had actually, I was literally the only person in the room speaking in favor of the poll tax. Everyone was against me, but it was a good student debate, and it was very good humoured. And she obviously was quite curious because the person speaking for the government was in a minority of one, and yet we were having a good-natured, good-humoured debate. We both left the college in 1988. And she went on to become one of the demonstrators in Tiananmen Square. Now, I don't know if it had anything to do with that experience, but...
Oh, what a heartwarming story. I tell you this. Something about this style of Tory just winds me up. Oh, yeah. What a wanker.
I do know that when she arrived...
What's he even doing there? Go and join the Lib Dems or something. He should be on stage with bloody Hannah Spencer. That's where he should be.
She was a strong supporter of the Communist Party and a strong supporter of Chairman Mao. And something about being here changed her view. And that is what I mean. And Oxford is one of the greatest universities in the world. And one of the reasons it is a great university is because it attracts brilliant minds from all over the world who then go back to their countries with whatever it is that they've picked up here. Now, I'm not prepared to chuck all that away and say that that kind of soft power is...
What soft power? China's still communist now. It didn't. Tiananmen Square didn't fucking result in anything. It was a successful government crackdown. China has gone from strength to strength. What? Oh, I just hate these people. I really hate them.
Vanity.
It's like the most naive, blue-eyed wankers in the world find themselves in the Tory party somehow. If it stays like this, it deserves to just be torched. Ugh.
That is absolute rubbish. That is one of the most...
Sorry, nobody... No, I'm not. But for the simple reason, Jeremy, you're now giving us a sweet little anecdote about
Oxford. It's not a sweet anecdote.
It's an example. It's a very important one. And unlike you, I've been a university teacher. I believed in this. I practiced it.
Okay.
It is centrally important. But that is not national. That is not the projection of the kind of myth that I'm talking about. That is a specific institution, one that I would passionately defend too. We're talking about something else. We're talking about the antics on the public stage. We're talking about the mouthing of platitudes, the shaking of hands, the kind of activities you undertook.
You know, like when David Cameron sat there boasting about looking Vladimir Putin in the eyes and being proud of his record on gay marriage. You know, this is the sort of shit Starkey's talking about. It's not serious. It's stupid. And it's laughed at by Russia. It's laughed at by Putin. It's made us a mockery of us. Oh, I hate these people. Blow me to Bermuda.
So in this book, I do point out that we are ranked third in the world globally by independent consultancies for the extent of our so-called soft power. That's the sort of the reach and the influence of our culture. And one of the most important factors in that ranking is the fact that we have 400,000 students from all over the world who come and study in British universities, second only to the United States. And that's one of the reasons they give us that ranking. And they describe Britain as having soft power. Now, you did...
Yay, we convinced a student to go and get mowed down in Tiananmen Square. Yay! What the fuck is he talking? What is this?
Just describe that as vanity. And I'm saying it's not vanity. It's actually something very important. And I think that if you're... And I do believe, by the way, I don't want a world in which just Britain is okay. I actually think so. The things that I believe in, treating people with dignity and respect, freedom and democracy, they're things that actually are important for all human beings. So if you are... So if you are an African country and you're thinking, do I go in the autocracy direction, because China seems to be doing very well, or do I go in the democracy direction, then whether things are working in the UK actually has an influence. Now, at the moment, they're not working terribly well. They're not working terribly well in America. The two great exponents of democracy, the two countries that between them set up the international order, have both got massive issues. And I want us to sort those out, because I do...
But you don't think, even for a second, that the actual reason for that is the system itself? He's just said China's doing really well and we're up shit's creek. Why is that then? It doesn't cause you to question any of your priors, Jeremy. Just double down, do more of the same. This is an ideologue. This is the definition of an ideologue. The trouble is that the shit we've been doing, we just haven't been doing it hard enough. We need to do the same, only again more. More of the same. Tories have no hope if this is still the thinking within the party.
I think that the power of example is something very important.
Do you really think that how we conduct ourselves will make the faintest impression on 99% of Africa? Do you actually believe that this endeavour, which was very much part, again, I talked about liberal empire, to introduce democracy in Africa. It's surely a simple absurdity. Tribal societies cannot democratize. If we've not learned that lesson from Afghanistan, from Libya, from virtually everywhere that we've tried it, we constantly try.
From Uganda, from Somalia, from Liberia, from Haiti. I mean, the list goes on and on, David. Fucking hell. No, let's just keep on trying to do more of the same.
Ourselves in knots. I mean, I'm fascinated by this. I think we're now getting to the absolutely fundamental question. This is why I said I felt you really were part. And I'm not using it as a term of abuse. I'm not doing a Farage. I'm trying to analyse why I think you are part of that world. You seem to me, you'll be familiar with David Goodhart's two categories of the somewheres, the rooted, and the anywheres. those believers in universalism. You are fundamentally a universalist. You believe, you've just said now, all human beings are entitled to this, that, the other. But isn't that A, a deep myth, and B, isn't it profoundly unconservative? Can I remind you of the by far the greatest leader of the Conservative Party, not the greatest Conservative Prime Minister? Can I remind you of Disraeli? In the speech after he'd given the vote to my ancestors, because my father was a toolmaker as well, so the skilled working class in 1867, in that great speech that he gives first in Edinburgh and then in the Free Trade Hall, he justifies it. And he said, in a progressive country, and Britain, this is seventh decade of the 19th century, Britain is a progressive country. Change is inevitable. And interestingly, the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations scandalously abbreviates the quotation at that point, because what Disraeli went on to say was, it's not a question that there will be change, there will be, it's what sort of change. Is it change in accordance with the traditions and customs of the country, Burke, or is it change in accordance with ruthless international liberal cosmopolitanism? You are a ruthless international liberal cosmopolitan.
Amazing. Amazing. Let's see what he says.
Well, all I can
come
say...
on, boast about it. The whole book is about that.
Right, okay. Well, all I can do is say that I think you're completely wrong to say that conservatives don't believe that all human beings have aspirations to being treated decently, to living in a free country.
Oh, you fucking twat. Everybody in the world is sitting there wanting liberal democracy. Everybody in the world. Sitting there, you know, from Tehran to Taiwan, just from bloody, you know, Peru to Timbuktu, just dreaming of having a liberal democracy just like ours. Fucking wanker.
To living in societies with which treat them with decency and respect. That's not the same as saying that we have a duty and an obligation to impose that on other countries, and we should certainly recognize that we have made many mistakes when we've tried to do so, that the imposition of parliamentary democracy immediately post-independence in much of Africa was not successful, although interestingly, over time, there are some African countries where it's possible to see that it's actually beginning to thrive. I think of Ghana, for example, as one of those countries. But you can point to huge failures in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we should certainly absolutely...
And also in every single other country in Africa, apart from like one or two tiny little examples that you can give. And I bet you, if you have a look at Ghana, it's probably not the swimming success story he's painting it as.
Recognize those failures. So this is not about imposing our system thoughtlessly on others, but that is not the same thing at all as saying that every human being aspires to living with the freedom and dignity and respect that we want for ourselves and our families. And I think they do. And we may have a difference there, but I think
we do.
Well, I'm just telling you now, my wife's Chinese, and I can absolutely tell you, by the way, it doesn't make me rootless to be married to a foreigner. It doesn't make me anything any less British either way either to be married to a foreigner. But I can tell you that she absolutely understands the difference between a free society and a society that is not free. But my idea of Britain, I think, probably is different to yours, because yes, I do have an idea that the brilliant things that we have done in our country can be a force for good around the world, not by imposition, but by showing that we have found ways to make things work, that we can combine prosperity and fairness and all the things that actually, and I actually still believe that liberal democracy, for all its failings, is a better system than the alternatives on offer. The very fact that we're able to have this debate is something that's incredibly encouraging and not possible in the China-led autocracy block of the world.
That, this is also bollocks, by the way, right? In, even in Iran, even in Islamic Iran, right? They have debates like this all the time. Okay, you can actually look it up on Farsi YouTube. They have really heated debates, and they shout at each other. Okay, if they're really heated debate, the idea that you can't have a debate in some of these other countries is wrong, I'm afraid. Including in Russia, by the way, even in Russia, even in Putin's Russia, they have debates. Like this notion that you can't do this in some of those other countries is flatly incorrect, I'm afraid. So again, a reality check. Let's just look at lived reality. Okay, if you go and try to, you know, burn down a mosque in Iran, okay, you're going to get the police after you. Or if you deliberately provoke the authorities, okay, by doing illegal things, the police are going to come out after you in exactly the same way as if you do illegal things here, the police will come after you, okay? So again, these are dishonest distinctions that are made, that are narratives that are made to make us feel better about ourselves for a system that is failing and frankly has been failing since 1945, if you ask me. This has been a nation in decline. So the notion that this, a nation in decline, is a model that other people look to and aspire to is delusional. It is delusional from Jeremy Hunt to believe this. Just copium. It's a virtue signal. It's nonsense, as Starkey said, or as he accused Starkey of.
Now, my argument in the book, and by the way, I do say in the book that I think that if necessary, we should withdraw from the European Convention on Human Rights. And I say that with great reluctance, but I say it because in the end, I would prefer to reform it, but in the end, I think voters are entitled to expect their elected representatives, the people they send to Parliament, to be able to control who comes into the country and who leaves it. I think that's one of the fundamental things people expect. And if the other participants in the ECHR, because it's run by unanimity...
I'm not sure if I can get through all of this. Maybe we'll have to come back to it with a part two. But so far, I mean, we've been going an hour here. He's been driving me up the frigging wall. We're 37 minutes in. We might do a part two on this. If people want it, let's get to the end of this answer, and then we'll, you know, call an audible, as the Americans say.
Are not prepared to go along with the reforms that are necessary to control illegal migration, stop illegal migration. So I'm perfectly prepared to take difficult decisions, but the view I have, which may be very different to yours, I don't know. I think if you step back and you look at the world we're in today, sadly, it's becoming quite similar to the 1980s in that it is a struggle between autocracy and democracy. And when I grew up in the...
Bollocks, again, bollocks.
1980s, we couldn't take the future of democracy for granted because we had the Soviet Union that was there, that was willing and able to invade other countries to promote their own ideology and to constrain them under their yoke. And we knew that democracy might be something that we had to fight for. Well, I'm afraid I think we are now back in that same world where there is a global argument now between autocracy and democracy.
Bullshit, bollocks framing again. This man is an ideologue. He is ideologically possessed, is what Jeremy Hunt is. The definition of an ideologue won't let his basic, stupid ideas from when he was a student in the 80s go. This is an ideologue.
And I do want Britain to play its part in helping to win that argument this century, just as we did in the last century. And I think we can do that. It'll be done in a different way to last time, but I think that is part of Britain's global vocation. I'm not someone who says we should just pull up the drawbridge and say, you know, sod the rest of the world, we're fine, thank you very much. No, that is not my view of Britain at all. I think we do have, at our best, a global vocation. But what I say is this: we are in a mess and we need to sort out that mess, because at the moment we're not a great example of democracies working at their best. All the things that are going most badly wrong, all the things that are causing anger and division, in the end, they're rooted in the challenges facing our economy. And so I think that is the central challenge now that we need to address.
All right, let's leave it there. We're about 40 minutes in. If people want to see a part two, we can do a part two, but he is driving me up the wall. Thanks, Connor. You've given me a headache. Hope you're happy. Bloody hell. What's depressing is that Jeremy Hunt is not even a boomer. Not even a boomer. He's a Gen Xer. I'm going to have to deal with these people as well now. Anything to get rid of that type of politician. Disaster zone. My gosh. I wonder how the people in the room received that stuff. Were they shaking their heads? Were they feeling angry in the way I was? Or were they saying, oh, were they nodding? Were they saying, oh, they're a great idea. Great idea, Jeremy. We need to, yeah, yes, it's the democracies versus the autocracies. Fucking wank. Pick up a course, ladies and gentlemen. Pick up a course. What am I going to do? I'm gonna disappear. And, you know, after I play pickleball tonight, I'm about to go and play pickleball. I'm going to go and play retro football games from my youth and withdraw into a haze of nostalgia and escapism. So I don't have to think about this sort of crap anymore. My God. Maybe I need to go into a matrix made up exactly of like 1992 forever. Pretend all this doesn't exist. It's like being in Groundhog Day listening to these people. Nothing will wake him up. This is an ideologue. Nothing will wake him up. That's what I've said before, right? You say what you want about Tone, right? Tone is less of an ideologue than Jeremy Hunt. Less of an ideologue. In this book, he makes peace with the fact that not everybody has to have the same system. You can actually get stuff done, like in Singapore and in China. Not so Jeremy. Like I said, the true believers are in the Tory party. The true believers. Starmer, you say what you want about him. He's got very few substantive beliefs apart from full force of the law, the international law, right? A systems man. But he is less ideologically possessed than Jeremy Hunt, in my view. Oh, stressing to come across such unvarnished wank as that. And he's still in the Tory party now. Still an MP now, sitting in Parliament. Pick up the mega bundle, ladies and gentlemen. I'll see you later. If you're wondering what football games I'm playing, there's one called what were those two games I was playing? I'm gonna have to look them up. I can't even remember what they are now. I'll have to tell you next time. But they're really good, really good. Bit of nostalgic. One's like Sensible Soccer, and yet you play as a player manager, starting in the bottom league, working your way up. And the other one's like a deck building card game, also set in a world with teletext and CFAX and things like that. Brilliant games. You can find them on Steam. Pick them up on a sale. Ugh. Oh, I feel sick. Bye. If you liked this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.